owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. The United States Navy took an early interest in aviation and its potential to use as a weapon of war. On November 14, 1910, a civilian pilot, Eugene Ely, demonstrated that an airplane could take off from a ship. 2 months later, he successfully made a landing on a special platform mounted on the cruiser USS Pennsylvania. Ely is reported to have said, "It was easy enough. I think the trick could be successfully turned 9 times out of 10. However, the first military Navy aviator became so more by chance than purpose. On December 16, 1910, Theodore Gordon Ellison, nicknamed Spuds, submitted a request for flight training to the Secretary of the Navy. At roughly the same time, aviation pioneer Glenn Curtis sent a note to the Navy offering to train an officer at no charge in the construction and operation of his Curtis biplane. The Navy thought this was a fine idea, but by the time the orders got down to the detail officer, it was already December 23rd, and everyone was trying to leave and get home for Christmas. The detail officer grabbed the first request he saw on his desk, the one belonging to Spuds Ellison, and the orders were issued. 2 weeks later, Ellison was on North Island in San Diego Bay learning how to fly and repair the Curtis biplane. He would become the first person to be launched from a new experimental catapult system. The first attempt nearly cost him his life, but the second attempt was successful. On February 27, 1928, Ellison received a dispatch that one of his daughters was ill. He immediately took off on an amphibian plane to make the two-hour flight home. He never arrived. Despite a month searching for the plane, the wreckage was never found, but Ellison's remains washed ashore on April 11, 1928. Now, our guest today did not become a naval aviator by chance. Rather, her path was one of purpose and determination, a focused quest to not only become a member of one of the Navy's most elite groups, but also to do so when gender barriers in the military aviation community were still and are still being broken. She's a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy, one of the first women to fly a combat mission over Iraq in 2011, and the first woman to drop lead on ISIS heads from an F-A-18 Super Hornet. She has a new book fresh off the press. It's called Jet Girl, My Life in War, Peace, and the Cockpit of the Navy's Most Lethal Aircraft, the F-A-18 Super Hornet. Carolyn Johnson, Jet Girl, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
Thank you so much for having me, Ben. I apologize for my voice. I've been on tour, and so I lost it from all the talking and travel and germs. So instead of hurting your viewers' ears, it'll come back here in just a second. I haven't talked. I took a vow of silence for the last 24 hours, but this is the first time I've talked, so I apologize. My whole job is to be good at speaking on the radio as a weapons systems officer, so I apologize again. But you're correct. I was one of the first women to fly over Iraq since 2011. So when we pulled out in 2011, we were the first to go back in. Thank you for having me.
Well, Carolyn, slow down. Take it easy. We've got a whole hour. Have a sip of Basil Hayden's. You'll be okay.
I've got it.
But honestly, tell me if my producer, we get it to a point where you can't continue. That's okay. We understand. Carolyn, I got to tell you, the first question that comes to mind when I was reading your book and when I heard about you, and in particular your book tour, you were pretty much born and raised in Colorado Springs. Why on earth not the U.S. Air Force Academy and the Naval Academy instead? I know our KRDO listeners are going to want to hear the answer to this.
Everyone asks that question. They say, why did you choose Navy? For my Navy fans, I would say there's no better place to be stationed than the Naval Aviation Bases. So we have a pretty good choice of location. But for me, really, it was about the initial experience in college. I didn't want to stay in Colorado Springs. I wanted to get out and see the world, and the Navy was the first place that offered that to me.
Okay, so coming out of the, and I'll tell you again, Caroline, I'll do more of the talking here today, which my listeners don't want to do, but I'll try and fill some airtime so you can give your voice a break. Explain to us real quick, you graduated from the Naval Academy, you became a WSO, a Weapons System Officer. Explain to us what that is for people who are not familiar with it. They probably know the term RIO from Top Gun, but they may not know what a WSO is and what role they play.
Yeah, exactly. So I like to tell people and reference Top Gun because most people know it. You know, your goose as a weapons systems officer and where it really progressed from that RIO role to the WSO is when we switched to F-18 Super Hornets. So we were more than just radar intercept officers. Now we have such a suite of weapon systems. So not only the radar, but the FLIR, which is a forward-looking infrared sensor. And so what we do as WSOs is we sit in the back of the plane, and I managed all the bombs, missiles, weapons. I communicated all the tactical systems, and I was able to also navigate the plane. So the pilot's responsibility was putting the plane where it needed to be and pushing the button to release the ordnance. And then all our weapons are so smart these days. I controlled all the terminal guidance of the weapons, and I would set them up to be able to release them from the plane.
Okay, and I'll tell you were flying the F-A-18 Super Hornet, and, man, I tell you, if I could, I wanted to be a pilot, Caroline. I took the ASFABs, but I wore glasses at the time, and so the Air Force recruiter said, hey, how about being an engineer? Nope, I wanted to be a pilot, so I never had a military career. But if I thought about one of the aircraft that I think would just be a kick in the pants to fly, I mean, the Super Hornet would be it. It's a twin engine, carrier-capable, multi-role aircraft. And to explain to some folks, the F-A designation, people might be familiar with the F-16, the F standing for fighter. In the case of the Super Hornet, the F-A is for fighter attack. And just to let people know how good it is at that role, in the first day of the Gulf War, as I understand it, Caroline, correct me if I'm wrong, 4 F-A-18s took off on a mission to bomb an airfield. So they're loaded down with 2,000-pound bombs to drop from the air to the ground. They received a notification by an airborne control aircraft that told them that two Iraqi MiG-21s were up on the hunt. 40 seconds from the time they got that warning, after that, two MiGs were burning scraps of metal in the Iraqi desert. And these airplanes did that carrying 2,000-pound bombs. They didn't drop their fuel tanks. They just took care of business and went on. Is that a very excitable summary of the amazing Ferrari of an aircraft that you were flying, Caroline?
That is such a cool, that's such a cool story. And it really highlights what the perks of the F-A-18 are, in that we can operate air-to-air and air-to-ground in the same mission seamlessly without releasing any of our weapons, you know, or jettisoning them off. And so in training and in combat, we did that all the time. So we carried air-to-air missiles, and we also carried air-to-ground ordnance, both bombs and missiles and bullets. And that is what we were experts at. And so, yeah, great description. Thank you for telling that story.
Well, of course, it was even better. It was a true story. So, hey, you know, I know it's entertainment, but we have to stick to the facts. Yeah, I tell you, we had the founder of the Navy's Top Gun program on the show before, Dan Peterson, and he was describing one of the challenges. Yeah, great guy. One of the challenges that they faced in Vietnam was that the number of air-to-air kills dropped substantially over Korea and World War II. Well, one of the problems was the F-4 Phantom didn't have a nose gun.
Yeah.
But the F-18 sure does, right? You got a 20-millimeter burp in the nose there?
Correct. We typically carry 300 bullets in the nose, which is enough to do some damage.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay, and just one other question, and then we'll get off of this topic. I just kind of am geeking out about the aircraft, Caroline. And I know you're a huge advocate of the plane as well. But top speed, 1,190 miles an hour, that's fast.
I hope that's what Wikipedia says. You know, that number is technically classified, not that specific number, but I think it has a great capability. And, you know, we were able to really leverage that in using our tactics against the enemy and really outperforming in all different situations that we found ourselves in, whether it was a simulated enemy in training or the actual enemy in Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan.
Caroline, I'm crushed to learn that something on Wikipedia might not be fully accurate, but let's just say it has a top speed in excess 1,190 yeah. miles an hour. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by Caroline Johnson. Her book, Jet Girl, is hot off the presses. You're going to want to read it. And I tell you, in the prologue to her book, she starts off with a chapter, and in quotation fingers, I say, launch the alert fighter. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Caroline about what it's like to be in one of these outstanding aircraft. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back, listeners. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined on the phone by Caroline Johnson. Caroline is in the middle of a book tour. She just released her new book, Jet Girl, My Life in War, Peace, and the Cockpit of the Navy's Most Lethal Aircraft, the F-A-18 Super Hornet. And I'll tell you, because she's on a tour, she's got a little bit of a rough voice here, but she is a warrior, so we're gonna carry on like good sailors should. So, Caroline, I appreciate your patience and your willingness to put up with us here. While you're recovering, I teased in your book in the prologue, you referenced that, you know, the words launch the alert fighter. You're sitting in your cabin in your polka dot socks, which were probably not, I'm guessing, official uniform socks. But you talk about, and I tell you, I really like the book because it's not the traditional book that a warrior would write. There's lots of facets of your story and the message you try and bring out. But in that prologue, you really introduce us to the importance of training and repetition. And you just sort of walk us through all the stuff going on as you scramble to that fighter, as you get in, get strapped in, all the stuff going on from, you know, making sure the blast shield is up so no one gets blown off the deck, on down to the telltale sort of click as you know that the aircraft squats down so you know that the catapult's engaged. What is this one of those things where you're thinking, but you can't think? You don't have time to think, Caroline?
I would say what's so amazing about Navy training is that we are so well trained and we are so well adapted to operating under pressure that it is just second nature. Your mind's moving a million miles a minute about which direction is the enemy coming from. Where am I going to launch off? What's going to happen? And your body is moving, checking these things, and it's a mental checklist. So it is amazing. It kind of, you're moving so fast, you're not thinking, but you also are because it's just so, you know, you've got it on such good lockdown, I would say.
Okay, and I'll tell you, one of the things I learned a lot from your book, one of the things I honestly never thought about, but that's the reason we do this show, is to inform civilians. You know, a lot of us pack a lunch and go to work. It just never crossed my mind that a pilot and a wizzo would also have to pack a lunch, and you kind of give us a list of the things you included in that lunch, but no Skittles, M&Ms, or anything else small that could roll around the cockpit. Why is that important?
Correct. So it's called foreign object debris and damage. And so what'll happen is if you drop hard candy or trail mix or anything like that, it can get jammed in the flight controls and, you know, eventually get them to stick, or it can jam in there so that you don't have the precise movements that we require to land on the aircraft carrier. And so it's very, very regulated, and we're very careful about what we pack. And if something falls, that we make sure we get it, which also happens at another time in the book. There's another story where we drop things, and it doesn't end up so great. But I'm sure you're going to talk about that later, too.
Oh, I don't know. It's a family show, Caroline. but we will. So, and I, yeah, because, I mean, you don't want to try to explain that you had to bail out of an $80 million aircraft because of a Skittle, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
The other thing I learned... You're going one way, one of your fellow female aviators. So you're transiting into the whatever you'd call it, the zone, the box, the attack box that you're assigned to. Female
over
aviators. I'm sorry.
Over the beach.
Oh, over the beach. There you go.
Combat.
And another female aviator's going the other way, and you're texting each other.
Yeah. Yep.
You can do that?
Our jets are pretty smart. They even have text messaging in them. It's not traditional text messaging like you would expect, you know, in the iPhone days. But we use a keypad, and we can type in words, and we can type in messages over the Link 16 network. And it's actually very, very effective. So sometimes when you're out of communications range, so if it were like today and I were coming in broken over the radio like I am, it's actually text messages will go through kind of like over a cellular network. And so sometimes in combat, we would get text messages that would tell us where the areas of combat were from the troops on the ground. If they couldn't talk or if they were in dire need of help, they could text us and it would show up that it's called a free text, and a free text would appear and we can click into it. But we can also use it in our cockpit too.
And I assume that's encrypted though, right?
It is. Yeah.
Okay.
Correct.
All right. Well, and you mentioned it, and I do want to get to it because this is something, a lot of the themes in your book talk about the challenges of being a female aviator. One of the more practical considerations that is always bounced around in my little bean, you talk about the chapter talks about where one of your commanders talks to you about the importance of staying hydrated. Now, again, Caroline, this is a family show, but it is such an example, I think, of the practical challenges that are faced. And let me just introduce by saying men and women have different parts. You're on a mission. And I've been in an F-16 cockpit. I've been in a Cobra cockpit, an A-10 cockpit. It's very cramped. And you're on a long mission, and on occasion, nature calls. As best you can, explain to us how the Navy or any of the manufacturers have kind of, sort of, maybe done a good job of taking care of that.
Yeah. So I will say that's one major challenge of being a woman, in that a lot of the flight gear in previous times was not specifically made for a woman, made for a woman's body. And if it was, it was pretty ill-fitting. And so the urination devices are no different to relieve yourself. And so we used a device called an AMXD, and it's very archaic and kind of like a Lego kit. So brings you back to when you were a kid, putting pieces and parts together to make this contraption work. And I won't go deep into it, but, you know, there's a pump that's the size of a VCR tape, and that connects with a hose to a bag and to a collection device, essentially. And that collection device, you wear it, and so that is supposed to suck the pee, essentially, out of you. And it's not very effective. The batteries, we used to have lithium-ion batteries, but they were produced so long ago that the batteries have actually died and bled out. So we use AAA batteries, six AAA batteries per cycle, and a cycle lasts about 20 to 30 seconds. And so, you know, just if you think about the physiology and you think about the effects, it's not a very effective system. A good backup system that we also carry is a funnel. You know, I won't tell you, I did 42 combat flights, and I will say I tried to use this device on one of them, and it was such a traumatic experience that I never used it again. If I was in desperate, dire straits, I would use the funnel, but it's very difficult because I'm very tall. And the ergonomics, the cockpit's not very high, and I couldn't get it situated, you know, to get in the bag very well.
And Caroline, you've got to put this whole thing together at the moment where the need arises,
correct.
Or is it already assembled?
Yeah.
Or?
No, correct. So, you keep the pump and the bag in your flight bag, and then, you know, you wear this device, and it has a tube that's like 18 inches long that you have to pull out of your flight gear. You have to unstrap from the seat. You have to get it, you know, everything unzipped. You feel like Houdini in the back of the aircraft or in the front of the aircraft because, you know, it's so cramped and you're trying to move around and get everything situated while your eyes are also bulging out because you don't want to use it unless you're in dire, dire straits.
Sure.
And the need is there. So.
Well, and again, that might be too much information for our listeners, but I've always been curious about that. And again, to me, that's a practical reality that speaks to one of the overarching themes of your book is just the challenges that female aviators face. Some of them much more, let's just say, higher level. But, I mean, just that practical reality of if we want you to fly and fight, darn it, we got to give you the tools. I mean, you know, we can put people on the moon. We can send things to Mars. I don't know. Has this gotten fixed since then, Caroline, or is it still?
So we have some very dedicated working groups who are working with the engineers like yourself to hopefully fix this problem because long-term what women typically resort to is tactical dehydration, which is really hard on your kidneys for an extended period of time. And when you deploy that often, it's tough. And so they are working on a solution, and we have the Air Force and Navy have come together to try to solve the problem. So I think it's going to get better, and hopefully they'll invest some money and some resources to overcome the, you know, just the basic physical barriers. Because if you think about it, you know, it also applies to combat roles in women who are on the ground, because a lot of the times you don't want to put yourself in a vulnerable position, you know, by having to, it's a family, you know, by having, when nature calls, stop and do all that stuff. So, yeah, we'll see. Hopefully we find a solution here soon.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're very pleased to be joined by Caroline Johnson. She's got a great book out called Jet Girl, talking about her experience in the cockpit of the F-18 Super Hornet. When we come back, we're going to talk more about some of the other issues related to the challenges of being a female aviator. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Caroline Johnson. She is a former WISO, a weapons system operator in the back of an F-18 Super Hornet. She's got a great new book out called Jet Girl, My Life in War, Peace, and the Cockpit of the Navy's Most Lethal Aircraft, the F-18 Super Hornet. Caroline, our discussion before the break was probably an awkward transition to... But I do want to talk about this because, you know, on American Warrior Radio, we've got male warriors and we have female warriors. And I know I shouldn't have to say this, but I'm going to anyway. And I emphasize that as a Naval Academy graduate, as a female warrior, you had to go through and qualify in the very same aspects that the males did. For example, you've got a great chapter, and we don't want to give too much away because we want folks to buy the book, Caroline, but you've got a great chapter talking about the SEER school, the Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape school. You had to go through that and survive it just as, you know, as much as your male counterparts. But I tell you, the one part that just really struck me, and I'm going to go ahead and read a passage from your book, give you a little more time to recover your voice. You're talking about you were assigned to the Black Lion Squadron, and there was an event called the Hail and Bail, which is sort of a, you know, welcome to the squadron for new members. And so you walk up to this house, and let me just read, if you don't mind, Carol, a little bit from that chapter. "Hi, nice to meet you. I'm Caroline," I said, extending my hand. "Come on in," he said, gesturing toward the house, ripped straight from the pages of Southern Living magazine. "I'm Coma," he said, using his call sign. I followed Coma to the kitchen where he introduced his wife, and it suddenly dawned on me that he was not a peer, but the home's owner and my new XO. "Oh, sir," I said, suddenly switching into a formal address, "thanks for having us, and ma'am," I added, turning to his wife and extending my offerings, flowers and Ghirardelli-tipped strawberries for the girls. I'll just leave you girls, Coma said, excusing herself. And I'm going to skip forward a little bit. She's talking to you. Introduce yourself. And then she goes out and introduces you to the rest of the women there. And one of them says, so we're dying to know who's the lucky man. Pardon? I said, confused. Which one is your husband? We're always happy when a new couple joins the squadron. I said, cheeks reddening. I'm not really. I glanced down at my hand. Oh, is it a boyfriend? Heather said. That's okay. Not everyone is married. Well, actually, I'm not married to anyone in the squadron. I'm in the squadron, I said. I'm the new Wizzle who just joined. The buttery Chardonnay Heather had been sipping looked like it had instantly soured as her mouth scrunched into a circle. A weird, painful ooh sound hissed past her lips. And then, in a gesture that puzzles me to this day, she held her hand up in front of my face and turned away. She took a few steps toward the rest of the women who hadn't heard our conversation and pointed, she's the new girl in the squadron.
Mm-hmm.
That alone, Carolyn, to me, just speaks volumes of how far we have not come in really making this gender equality transition in our military. And in this case, we're talking about the other officers' wives.
Yeah. I would say that fighter community, especially in some of these elite communities, are very gender normative in the most 1950s, terminology. The men are out working and are out doing these jobs and serving their country. And for the most part, their wives stay at home and take care of the home front just because they're such demanding jobs. And generally, you're in remote places and their jobs are not able to follow them. So, it is tough and it's not expected. And my outward appearance, the number of times I've heard once I tell people what my career was, oh my gosh, I would have never guessed, you don't look like you would be in the military or you don't look like you would fly fighter jets or fly in fighter jets. I ended up being able to take it as a compliment most of the time because, I'm okay with that talent and these jobs, they don't look a certain way. And that's one of the parts that I think is so cool is you don't have to fit this like stereotype. Warriors can look, they can be blonde, they can be beauty queens on the weekend, and they can be the fiercest warriors you've ever met in your life. And so it's only a matter of time until we overcome that stereotype. And that's why I was so excited to be here today. And when I was like, no, I told my publicist, I was like, if they'll still have me, I want to come because, representing the rest of warriors out there and expanding the civilian's point of view that, you can look like, anything and
sure.
Be a warrior is cool.
Well, sure. And that's why I'm so glad to have you on the show as well, because we all, male, female, civilian, military, need to kick in those doors. And tell us a little bit about why in your – so I can't help but think somebody out there is going to say, why should I care? I'm a civilian. Well, maybe part of the reason they should care is it costs what, $6 million, $8 million to train a pilot? And something you quote, something like 83% – of the female pilots in the fighter community are getting out the first chance they get. I mean, a very practical reality is not only is it not fair and not a good idea, but it's costing us money.
Yeah, well, your taxes, your taxpayer dollars at work, and it's the security of our nation because the work that we do abroad is protecting our border, not just our borders, but protecting our way of life from the visceral evil that exists in the world. And so you need the best and the brightest. And the fact of the matter is women graduate from post-secondary education. Last year it was 55%. This year I think it's at 60%. And there are more women graduating with STEM degrees than even men. And so those are the people who are most inclined to do these elite jobs. And so we need to overcome that bias. Otherwise, you're excluding a whole viable portion of the population who would otherwise be great members of the service, by having these antiquated views. And so, if you care about your way of life, if you care about your tax dollars, and if you care about the ability for the next generation to be able to thrive in the workplace, whether it's tech or finance or the military, we need to change those attitudes and change the conversation and let people know that you can do this. It doesn't matter, you know, what it formerly looked like. Here's people out here doing it that look like you, sound like you, and will support you as you embark on these challenging career paths.
Well, and I want to come back to this a little bit later in the show, Caroline, because I just think, I mean, to me, that's the gist. Not only is your book entertaining and informative, there's a very strong message in this book that everybody needs to see and to hear, so I'm glad. And I tell you, coming back to sort of the practical reality of this, later in the book, you discuss a situation where you were meeting one of your fellow pilots' wives, and she asked a question that made me shake my head reading the book. She asked if you shared quarters with her husband. Mm-hmm. And it seems sort of ignorant, but I tell you, I've had this conversation. I'm very involved with the USS Tucson, which is a Los Angeles class fast attack submarine. And yeah, that's a real challenge that another part of the Navy is going through. The practical reality is you've got 138 men in a tube about 100 yards long. There is absolutely mm-hmm. no privacy. And mm-hmm. The sailors I talked to kind of shrugged. It's like, you know, we don't care as long as they can do their job. But it was the wives who were mm-hmm. concerned about, okay, my husband or my boyfriend's going to be at sea for, you know, underwater for 4 months with a woman, and I just don't like that idea. So I'm glad you brought that up. A little bit about, you know, on the aircraft carrier, different situation. We're talking a floating city, but even mm-hmm. then you had sequester is not the right word, but you had designated quarters for yourself and the other women pilots were on board. And how many was the, what'd you call it, the shark tank?
The shark tank, yeah. So there were six of us, myself and five roommates, and we were the fixed wing female aviators on board the ship. And to get six of us in a room, there was actually three different squadrons. So there was one other fighter squadron and then one E-2 squadron. And we all lived together, whereas all the men in our squadrons, they lived within their squadron, you know, all one squadron to a room. And so they would live in a three-man room or a two-man room or a six-man room. But for us as women, you know, number one, we were very fortunate to have each other because we could support each other. We could relate to the challenges. And we lived in a beautiful space. Our boss's boss made sure we got an ample amount of square footage, which on an aircraft carrier for six women, we probably had 200 square feet, which was probably one of the largest rooms on the boat, and we appreciated it. Then there was another room of women, and they were the helicopter pilots, helicopters, and intelligence officers. And so there are about two rooms of us on a carrier of 5,000. But we were lucky. Our enlisted lived 300 people in one room, stacked three high, and they were just in very tight quarters. So
now, and clearly you weren't the only women on board the USS Bush, George Bush.
No.
But because you were officers, obviously you had separate quarters than some of the enlisted.
Correct. And because we were aviators, they like to keep aviators living with aviators. Because our schedules, we operate on a very different timetable than the SWOs or ship drivers. Ship drivers get up early in the morning, and they go to bed pretty early, and then they're up all hours of the night standing watch, driving the ship. Whereas aviators, the U.S. Navy, one of our specialties is operating at night, and so we get up a little bit later in the morning, and we always fly late into the night. And we go to bed in the early hours of the morning. And so to keep us all on kind of the same schedule and circadian rhythm, because we have to make sure we get 8 hours of sleep at least, they like to keep us, you know, on our different schedules and stuff.
Sure, sure. And Caroline, when we come back, I want to kind of, if you, with your permission, I want to geek out a little bit more, but also to really establish your bona fides. You are a warrior, and I want to talk a little bit specifically about that mission where you successfully dispatched, I think it was 18 ISIS warriors, and when we come back, we'll chat a little bit about that. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. I'm joined by Caroline Johnson. The book is Jet Girl. Look for it literally out on your shelves this weekend. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Caroline Johnson. She is a former weapons system officer in the Super Hornet, the FA-18, just an amazing aircraft. She saw combat, I think she said 42 combat hours in the cockpit of that amazing plane. She just started a book tour. Her book is Jet Girl. Look for it. Particularly our Colorado Springs listeners, they're listening on KRDO. You'll be able to meet Caroline this weekend. Look for more information about that at the local station's website. Caroline, coming back, one of the things that's interesting to me about that I learned in your book, I guess I probably should have known this if I watch enough TV, but one of the very unique aspects of the Super Hornet is very often you just have to show up, and that's going to scatter the bad guys. I had Major General Dana Petard and Master Sergeant Wes Bryant who on the show. They were at the pointy end of the stick of fighting against ISIS. And you relate a couple situations in your book where there were troops in combat or close to combat, and all you had to do is just give them a nice, close haircut with that airplane, and that got the job done, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah, so particularly in Afghanistan, we were able to do shows of force and shows of presence, and that was able to deter the enemy. Iraq is a little bit different battlefield, but and they have a lot more weaponry that they were shooting at us at the time. But, yes.
Well, and I mentioned General Petard and Wes Bryant particularly because it made me think of them and their frustrations as the rules of engagement very slowly ramped up when it came to dealing with these bad guys. And it was interesting to me reading your book, Caroline, about how in many cases the sensors and the tools you had available to you, you were getting a front row seat from 20,000, 30,000 feet of particularly these ISIS bad guys on the ground. And it must have been very extremely frustrating for you and your pod to know you're there, you're armed, you're trained, you're ready to take care of business. But no, you know, by the time the request gets up the channels to Washington, I mean, it's 2 weeks later. Or I mean, yeah. I'm exaggerating, but, you know.
Yeah. So it was very difficult in that we sat overhead for so long because it was the beginning of the war in Iraq, you know, in 2014. And we were witnessing just utter, you know, utter disregard for human life. And unless they were attacking Americans or coalition forces on the ground, we were not able to use lethal force. And so, you know, those decisions are made at the top levels of the government. And all I can hope is that the senior military officials who are guiding our elected officials, you know, are getting the best intelligence that they can to make the best decisions, which I do have total respect for. But as an operator, and as so many of the warriors out there, we are under strict orders and we are under, you know, strict control. And that's all you can do is do your job. So sometimes that meant sitting on your hands and not employing weapons. But what we would do is we would record as much video and as much footage and get as high of fidelity of videos of ISIS committing crimes so that we could bring that back as evidence and have it sent back to D.C. to then continue to build the case that we needed to act and we needed to act now, you know?
Yeah. Now, Caroline, you did finally get your chance to put some lead on heads. If your voice can hold out, tell us about that particular mission.
I did. So in 42 flights, it was interesting. In the beginning, you know, we weren't employing many weapons. And then once we finally started to do that, you know, it was day two. My friend from the Naval Academy was actually day one, the first bombs against ISIS. He was in the right place at the right time. ISIS crossed the line that we had drawn in the sand, and so he employed. I was on duty that day. I had a long day of duty the day before, but we were up in the vicinity of Mount Sinjar where ISIS was persecuting the Yazidis. And so in the current news cycle, we have a lot about Nadia Murad, who just won the Nobel Peace Prize, for speaking out as a Yazidi against ISIS. And she has a new book out that's amazing as well. So we were overhead trying to protect the Yazidis. We were up near Mount Sinjar where ISIS had pushed them up on the mountain. And we were searching to make sure there were no ISIS in the vicinity that were going to attack them. And on the north side of Mount Sinjar, we found two armored personnel carriers, which are essentially tanks with people in them, and one up-armored Humvee that had a grenade launcher on it. And they started attacking this village of Yazidis, and there were men, women, and children just sprinting for their lives, running, trying to get away from these attacks. And so we immediately called it in to the ground commander and said, hey, this is what we found. They got a drone overhead to confirm and to make sure that it was positively identified as ISIS. It got sent back to D.C., and at that point, the release authority was held with the Secretary of Defense, and so he approved it. It got passed back down to us, and we were able to push in. There were four jets on station, and it just happened to be my pilot and I that had the right gas. We were in the right place. We had the target locked on. And so they authorized us to employ two bombs and then a laser-guided Maverick to neutralize the threat. And so once they got out in the open, away from any structures or civilians, we were able to employ on them. We neutralized the first tank. We disabled the up-armored Humvee and blew that up. And then our wingman came in and cleaned up the second armored personnel carrier, which is a tank, thereby neutralizing the threat and saving the Yazidis on the ground. So it was a pretty good day for us.
Well, yeah, and I can imagine when you landed back on the carrier after that mission, there were a few high fives going around. At the end of the day, I think you said there's 18 bad guys that were...
There the 16 ISIS KIA killed in action and confirmed, neutralized. So really interesting in that those attacks were witnessed live by our admiral. He watched via the drone feed, and so he saw the attacks live. The head of CENTCOM, he also watched the attacks live. And so when you do these attacks, you have to make sure they're so perfect, you know, down to the bomb impact angle that you program into the jet. And so I had practiced that so many times over and over and stepped through and videoed everything and made sure it was perfect, so that we had the correct evidence to bring back. And then the whole flight back was spent thinking and double-checking in your mind that you did everything according to our proper protocol and procedures. And then when we landed, we got out of the jet. There was some celebration with the ordnance people who had loaded our bombs and the enlisted people. Just they were excited because we were finally able to do our job. And then when I got out of the jet, my admiral actually met me at the bottom of the stairs and congratulated me. And then I went to intelligence, and my commanding officer, the carrier air group commander, and a couple other commanding officers met me in intelligence to watch and make sure that the attack was executed according to procedure. And so what you do is you pull up all the video feed of your sensors and you check through everything. And no kidding, they have pages of checklists that you're checking off and inputting data to make sure that it's correct.
Well, and I tell you, Karen, thank you for doing that. I just want to make sure folks heard your bona fides. We've only got about a minute and a half left, and I don't want to leave with us. It's interesting, there's one quote that you had in the book that really struck me. You're flying a multi-million dollar airplane over places where women aren't even allowed to drive cars. What would you tell a young girl today who wanted to become a fighter pilot? About a minute.
It's the best job in the entire world. And I never thought that that's what I was going to go do in life. But I discovered it. I fell in love with it. And I put myself out there. And I worked hard. And I achieved these levels. And if I can do it, you can too. And so give it a try. I know there's challenges. But what we're out here doing is changing the landscape so that it's better for you. And so that you don't face the challenges that I did. And I wrote the book so that when you get older, you can read about it and see where I messed up and kind of have a roadmap for how you're going to do it better than I did. So go after it, pursue your dreams, and just dream of the highest heights and you will achieve those too.
Well, well spoken, Karen. I got to tell you, and I want men to read this book as well, because there's very important messages in there. One of which, you know, your opinion is that women right now in the fighter community can survive, but they're not quite allowed to thrive just yet, and we've got to get around to fixing that. Again, the book is Jet Girl, written by Caroline Johnson. Caroline, where can they find out more? You have a website?
Absolutely, jetgirlusa.com, or you can follow me on Instagram, jetgirlusa, and I would love for you to pick up a copy on Amazon and check out some of the video links. There's more to come, and it's just starting now. So thank you so much.
Carolyn, thank you so much. You're a real strong sailor. I'll leave it at that. Ladies and gentlemen, this podcast and over 250 others can be found at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Follow us on Facebook. If you'd like to support us, check out Patreon.com, American Warrior Radio. Until next time, take care.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.